Thank you. So maybe I should say the purpose of this talk. I was asked to give an overview about strongly correlated phenomena with cyclical interactions. Therefore, it will be a little bit an overview, not only work which I did, but over different topics. And please excuse for everybody if I'm just repeating what they all know. But I hope I can tell you something different. And my main goal is to stress the specific aspects of dipolar interactions. So what I'm really interested in is strongly interacting systems. So let us really focus on strong interactions and not like we heard yesterday about weak interactions and cross dependency by Chris Hignor. So what is the problem with the strongly interacting dipolar gases is that if my two dipoles are within the plane and polarized, they are nicely repulsive. But if they are on top of each other, they are strongly attractive, and this will lead to losses. So we have to overcome the anisotropy in our system and somehow circumvent collisional properties as soon as they are on top of each other. And one problem which can solve this is that we have heard many times to strongly combine the system into two dimensions. So let me try to plot it. So strong confinement into 2D. That means if you look at two dipoles, two polar molecules far apart, we know that there's an area where the dipole interaction is attractive. And somehow we have to circumvent that these polar molecules enter these areas and they undergo two-body collisions for calcium-rubidium, or if there are many polar molecules, three-body collisions. Now, if they collide straight on, this collision is suppressed because there's a repulsive barrier. But in principle, in 3D, nothing prevents them to make the detour. Now, if we combine them into two dimensions, if the second atom tries to make the detour, they have to pay a lot of energy due to the transfer of combining. So this approach is forbidden. And there is actually a maxima where if we take into account the transverse combining and the repulsive interactions, there's a maximum appearing a little bit slightly off of the center of mass collision. And this is a maxima due to transverse combining and the repulsive interaction. And so, yes?
Are these arrows free to...
No, polarized along that direction. So this is that, and we apply the electric field to polarize that. Otherwise, everything is wrong. Yes. Good, so one approach is, if you have strong dipoles, you have this maxima, and if this energy barrier is higher than temperature, and quantum mechanical tunneling is suppressed through the barrier, then you have suddenly arrived at a system of completely stable dipoles, that once they are far apart, the polar molecules stay far apart in two dimensions. So this requires strong dipole interaction. And with strong, I mean calcium-rubidium is unfortunately too weak. So we really need to go, as a theoretician, I like lithium cesium, but not every experimentalist like that. So we need a really strong dipole moment. But this absolute suppression works. Once we are in this regime, we can write down the Hamiltonian. So H is the sum over the kinetic energies of the particles plus the interaction potential, dipole moment divided by distance between the particles. And we can start to solve this many body system. And as a first proof that we can go into the strong interactions, it was analyzed that there was really a phase transition from a crystalline phase for strong interactions to a liquid phase, which can either be a Fermi liquid for fermions or a superfluid for bosons. So the phase diagram.
Dipole moment squared, right?
Dipole moment. Yeah, okay, it's a D, it's a dipole moment. An effective dipole. Yes. Small d squared.
What's the big D?
Big D, small D, square.
Good, so if you plot the phase diagram,
two-dimensionless parameters, we have temperature divided by
dipole moment square
divided by the interparticle distance A cubed.
Then we have a dimensionless parameter gamma,
which is the ratio between kinetic energy and interaction energy.
So interaction energy is D squared over A cubed.
Kinetic energy is
H bar squared over M
A squared.
Therefore, we have a dimensionless parameter E M H bar squared over A,
which is, one can also express it as the dipole length divided by the interparticle distance.
And so for very strong interaction, kinetic energy is negligible, and they expect a crystalline phase.
For weak interaction,
the system should be fluid, so either a Fermi liquid or a superfluid for bosons. And in between, there should be a phase transition. So up here, we have a thermal melting, classical thermal melting of a dipolar crystal. We have a characteristic energy scale, which is the quantum degeneracy. So this is H plus squared over M A squared. This is the scale where cosmic soundness transition takes place. Or if you have fermions, the fermions enter quantum degeneracy. And so here we have the thermal melting temperature.
And in the end, we have to be careful because our
intrinsic Hamiltonian assume that our dipoles are stable. So we cannot reduce this parameter arbitrarily. So there is an area where everything becomes unstable. But that means somewhere in between, we have the chance to see strongly correlated physics. So that's a classical phase. Superfluid is a classical phase. But in between, we can cross it.
Why does it become unstable to weak?
Because my collisions are suppressed. So then suddenly the barrier becomes too low, the particles can tunnel through, get on top of each other, and become this attractive part. That's essentially what Junier is seeing if he reduces the dipole moment. If he increases, he can increase the lifetime, but he still sees losses because his barrier is not perfect.
It's like a quasi-2D. It's not pure 2D, but you become quasi 2D.
Exactly, we are never true 2D. It's always quasi 2D.
So, but
and this case depends on the transverse combining.
The molecules are non-reactive, do you still have the same problem? Like, well, then you have 3D processes, I mean, three body processes. Right?
We have 3D processes, we have some bones, glue sticking together. So, yeah, I'm a theoretician, I don't like two molecules thinking to be too close to each other. I know there are much more experts here. So, but at the moment, I think we don't know how they behave exactly until we have the experiments. So let's try to get them away. Then we have a good theory. And then I will try during all my talk, try to see where we have a good theory to start with. Now, yes?
So, but that zero electric field, they are prevented by the P wave barrier.
If they are fermions, I completely agree.
Okay,
Yes. But somewhere in between, yes, if it is completely zero, you have some probably unstable for fermions, but in between there is this unstable region.
Do you know what would happen if one had a 1 over R squared interaction?
So, 1 over R squared interaction is, for me, I will call it long range interactions in two dimensions.
It's what?
It's a long-range interaction because 1 over r squared is no longer integrable. So we cannot have long-range interaction without a compensating background field. Like, we need a charge compensating the 1 over r cubed and 1 over r squared interaction. What will change is that I would,
this phase called the Higgs crystal, this will not have sound modes, but actually have an anomalous dispersion relation.
The critical temperature will be a little bit shifted, but otherwise.
Dependence on density, for example, cancel, right?
And oh yes, so I was now thinking about the difference is
will be kind of critical. I think it's will be a critical system.
Yes, because you get logarithm. Yes, okay. Yes. So the density should, the transition should be independent of density, actually.
But
just an
iteration. But I think it's also the idea you flip the role of those two phases, don't you? As the parallel interaction crosses two, you either get some indication of very low densities or very high densities, and that two is critical.
Exactly. Yes.
So
yes,
that,
yes.
Two is
critical.
Yeah. Precisely for that reason.
So are there two body interactions that are 1/r².
I'm not aware of, because you need a background charge. You need something to screen.
Yeah.
You screen the divergence of your interaction.
Yeah, and that, but these are not two like particles, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. They have two identical particles, cannot be 1/r², right?
But you can probably do the background just with a trap, can't you? I mean, after all, r² roughly does it for Coulomb interactions, so, yeah.
Like in iron traps, yes.
Yeah. And certainly, I mean, for, let's say, the rest, atoms, when you, probably what you're saying is true for atoms in a true ground state, right? But once you start kind of playing some, using maybe, if atoms exchange photons, you can certainly have
Saying that you can engineer a system that in the limited region of inter-particle separations would have 1/r², but it's not going to have universal 1/r² dependence, right? Really?
The retarded interaction of a p state atom with an s state atom has 1/r and 1/r² components in the retardation terms.
That's oscillating.
That's oscillatory. But it reaches out to very long range. It might actually be significant in line broadening in the Yokoko domain of the final transitions.
Good. Let me. On the first point, the right-hand interaction changes. And that's mainly from the start to ask the question, what is the order of this phase transition here? So naturally, one expects to be the first order phase transition, but there is actually a very simple argument, which is first pointed out by Spivak and Kivelson, and also some work based on work before, that this phase transition cannot be first order. And that's actually quite general, that if you have the first order of phase transition in 2D with dipolar interactions, where a density jump appears, this phase transition cannot be first order. And the argument is as follows. If you have a liquid phase and a crystalline phase, and then a first order phase transition, then we know that you can have the immersion of one phase into the other. So we have phase separations if you fix the particle number. Let's look at a large system and say one area is crystalline and add a little bit of bubble of liquid phase inside. Now the two phases have a different density. So we have here the density of my crystal and I have here the density of my liquid. And everything is at p equals 0, but fixed can be the potential. Now within this area, the energies are equal because it's a first order phase transition. Exactly at the critical point, the thermodynamic energies are equal, but I have to pay boundary energies. So the energy difference of adding such a bubble scales with the length of the bubble, and I have to pay this energy. But because I have a density jump, there is also a contribution from that polarity. So this density jump will feel the outside. And it turns out that this density-density jump actually is attractive. It gives a contribution L log N. So we have here a prefactor. But the contribution one gains from this density jump is proportional to the length of the bubble times log L. So that means if L is large enough, a dipolar interaction always wins. And that means the true ground state, how it the transition appears is there will be some superstructure of bubbles immersed into the other phase. And therefore not a true first order phase transition. So that the first point for dipolar interactions will be completely different than any short range interactions. Now, whether this plays ever a role in an experiment, we don't know. Because
the size of alpha?
Exactly, because nobody knows the size of alpha therefore nobody knows how large these structures will be. And certainly in all numerical systems with quantum Monte Carlo, we didn't see such behavior. There, it was always indication of first order, so we can expect that the size of bubbles are larger than our quantum Monte Carlo simulations. And they may be even larger than any system we can actually realize with polar molecules. So it may not all be a rule, but it's important that there is actually a difference. Good, so that was our first point. Now we can ask, crystalline phase is a boring phase. There can be excitic phases, so there's been a lot of discussion. I won't go into detail about potential excitic phases in between. Let's go into the Fermi liquid phase and ask about superconductivity. So that's, again, 2D fermions. And the search for superconductivity. Here I would like to refer to a work by Shora Shlapnikov and Nigel Cooper. So their idea was, let's engineer a little bit attractive interactions between my fermions, but still have a repulsive core. So the effective interaction that they are thinking of is some hard core with 1/r^6 at short distances. This will again stabilize all my collisional properties and make the system stable. But then we add a little bit of 1/r^3 attractive interaction. And the idea to achieve such an interaction is, so we apply, so this is a 4 lowest rotational states. We apply an electric field along the set direction. So we have dipole moments for these states. So the polar molecules down here have a dipole-dipole interaction. But if we now add a microwave field in a certain tuning, we add to the static dipole moment a rotational dipole moment. So coupling this state with microwave field adds a dipole moment which is rotating in a plane. And that means that as the two polar molecules are always rotating in phase, if they are on top of each other, they are always repulsive. If they are in plane, they are repulsive, attractive, and the attractive part is 2 times stronger. So in plane, it gives us an attractive part. So that means it, this rotational dipole moment has exactly the same shape, but a minus sign. So by balancing these two values, we can cancel dipole-dipole interaction. The next leading correction is something repulsive 1/r^6. If we keep a very weak attractive part by not complete cancellations, we can make such an interaction potential. Good, and for everybody not quite familiar, what we are doing is very similar to what magic angle rotation in NMR. So we just rotate the sample, let us spin it at a certain angle, and then dipole-dipole interaction cancels out. If the angle is not quite right, there's something remaining. And in principle, the ideas are very similar here. Good, now let us look at the simplest situation, spin the fermions. And as we have spinless, we can expect that there will be a p-wave superconductivity. Now one can solve the full BCS gap equations, and as a result, if the dipole interaction is very weak, and one applies first Born approximations for the dipole part, one arrives at the TC, which is like the Fermi energy, E minus 3 pi 4 kf r star. So r star is the dipole length. So the parameter this characterizes the strength of this attractive part, Kf, is the Fermi momentum. And what one doesn't really notice, if one is not working very hard in superconductivity, that's a very strange factor. Because for every other interaction potential, and we found those Born approximations, one actually would expect something like Kf squared, some parameter which scales with the interaction strength. And because this is small, Kf squared times this factor is usually arbitrarily small. So that means if we want to do P-wave superconductors with a Feshbach resonance, we have to blow up the Feshbach resonance extremely strong where we have strong losses to get strong enough dipole interactions, to get strong enough P-wave interactions for superconductivity. Now for dipolar interactions, this factor is reduced by Kf over R. Now where does this factor come from? That's the most simple understanding we can gain. That if you Fourier transform dipole-dipole interaction, EI KR in 2D divided by R to the cubed, we have to introduce a cutoff, so over some cutoff physics. We are only interested in the long-range part. Then we see we get a dominant part, so if we expand, there will be a constant from the 1 in the EKR, but if we expand it, already the first order expansion with K squared R squared will diverge. So that means that this will give rise to a contribution absolute value of K. And for everything which decays faster than 1 over R to the 4, this will give rise to K squared. So everything with 1 over R with alpha and alpha larger than 4, we get K squared. So everything short range, but which has a finite range, but decays faster, like quadrupole interactions, will give us K squared, and our P wave superconductivity will be strongly suppressed because everything enters in exponent. But as we have 1 over R cubed, we get a K here. And so this KFR is actually very special for dipolar interaction. So we see that, again, dipolar doesn't change fundamentally. It doesn't give rise to a new phase, but it strongly increases the P-wave superconductivity. Good. So that's another example.
Yes, it's not completely clear how, what can be the way you, like this is obviously in the regime of kind of weak,
it's not a perfect result,
right? So. But then there is a number which comes out here, right? And it's, we don't know what it is, yes,
I completely agree. But you don't have to increase dipolar interactions so strongly to go into the strong interactions. And nobody knows how the VCS-VC crossover looks like. So everything here is in the VCS limit and a weak argument. But it tells us that dipolar interactions can enhance superconductivity strongly.
The question about previous part. The arguments about second order phase transition, is it a very general argument or is it specific? Because it looks like general.
Here, the argument for every dipolar interactions in 2D with a first order phase transition with a density jump. So it's a very general argument, yes.
So there are no first order phase transitions?
Yes. Good. Then a lot of people.
Sorry, can I ask a question into like BEC, BCS? I guess one question what the two-body problem is like with that potential, if one's thinking about the BEC side.
Absolutely, yes.
And I guess from their calculations, one can say something about whether it has a bound state or not.
They assume there is no bound state. So their calculations is in the limit, but this is a weak interaction, and there is no bound state, and...
So somehow, if you could somehow tune it, then there really should be a transition.
I completely agree. No, I'm not expert in scattering in 2D. How about, in 2D there is always a bound state for any attraction or... Now we have to
the condition is some integral of the potential, whether that's positive or negative. And if it's negative, then also the bound state, but it's binding energy is exponentially related to e to the minus.
Yes, exactly, yes. I think, okay, these are
so
tricky questions.
So it depends on how cooler.
I'm very happy to discuss it. I think especially these questions have been discussed in bilayer systems, where one has two layers of polar molecules. Then we can call one layer spin up, the other spin down. We don't have collisions between the two species because they are separated in space. Now we can add interactions between the two, and so we can interlayer superfluidity. They form an S-wave pair. And then it's exactly your point. There's always a bound state for certain interactions, but it's exponentially small.
I think it's actually exactly zero for that case. So you cannot use your criterion, but there is a bound state. There is a bound state, but the integral over the potential is actually goes to zero. It's zero, exactly.
No, I think what I said is sufficient, but not necessary.
Yeah. So they have to work hard on this case, but there is a bound state.
So if you have no reactive molecules, you can have a 3D system. Then you have the anisotropic part of the interaction there. That how does it play a role? In principle, if you have if 1 minus 3 cos squared, so you have a 3D gas. Well, so here you are. So if you have the 1 minus 3 squared cos theta in the integral, in this integral, so it could change substantially.
It completely changes in 3D. I have no clue how it will look like in three dimensions. So how superconductivity will be in three dimensions, maybe there are experts here.
Well, in three dimensions, you also get p-wave
variance. You have the p-wave variance. P-wave variance, you have the p-wave variance.
Yes.
If you have not chemical reaction, for example, then you
if
can
If you don't have chemical reactions, you can do just what they did. I think there's also Shyamnikov and Baranov who did it in 3D. And you get p-wave variance.
But you have the cancellation, but I'm thinking is that anisotropicity, the 1 minus 3 cos squared theta, can change substantially the integral that you are doing there, no? So because 1 over r is 1 over r to the cube in a 3D system diverges, but when you add the 1 minus 3 cos squared theta, gets 0.
Yeah.
So.
But if you wave with a p wave function, you get something that's not 0. It's the same that happens if you tilt the dipoles in the plane like this, you can also get p-wave pairing. So we solve this problem. Anyway, if you tilt them in 2D, you get p-wave. So we just have to come up with a Cooper pair wave function that probes the attraction part of the potential. Mm-hmm. When the same thing happens in 3D, that was done by Baranov and Shyamnikov.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you know,
that brings me to my next topic. So let's now add the questions. What happens if we make very strong optical lattices? So that we have 2D optical lattices. Then the natural way which the Hamiltonian bubble write down will be hopping for the polar molecules minus J sum of alpha minus neighbor BI dot BJ plus the interaction between nearest neighbor and SX nearest sites due to the dipolar interaction. So that should be VIJ and I and J. And this one should be K like 1 over RI and this function cubed. And then one can ask whether one is allowed to write an onside interaction 1 over I and I squared. Now that I know it's a very controversial topic, but in my opinion, I don't like this topic. And I can provide you two reasons why I don't like this term. First, if you have reactive polar molecules, we know, so let's think again. So this term means that there are two polar molecules on the same lattice site. Now, people can correct me, but I don't know whether anybody has solved two polar molecules on one in a harmonically confined trap. But for me, it looks very horrible to actually get the bound state energies. So we don't know actually what happens exactly, whether they stick together for a long time, how they behave, what is the energies of these bound states. It will depend on microscopic analysis. So I don't know how this term behaves. So that's why I don't like this term. But even worse is that if you think of it, we want to have strong nearest neighbor interaction. So that look at the microscopic potential. If you have one polar molecule here and the second one here. Now, if you have strong nearest neighbor interaction, that means that the dipole-dipole interactions will strongly increase. So if this particle wants to hop onto this site, it will see the dipole-dipole interaction. So that means that we cannot just add a J for hopping here. We certainly have to add a correlated hopping term. And this correlated hopping term actually will be extremely huge, because the wave function here, for typical lattices, is 1/6 of the lattice spacing. So A0 is about, so if you have 16, if I may be correct, 16 recoil energies, it's A0 is 1/2 of the lattice spacing. That means the dipole-dipole interactions compared to here, compared to the position where the particle will exit the tunnel barrier, is 1/2 pi in power of 3, so that's a factor of 200. The dipole-dipole interactions increases by a factor of 200. Now, to get something interesting, the dipole-dipole interactions has to be here of the order of 0.2, 0.3 recoil energy. Otherwise, we don't get interesting physics. 0.2 recoil energies times 200, we end up with 40 recoil. So that's not a small perturbation to our optical lattice. That's the largest contribution to our optical lattice. So that means I don't like this term, not because the on-site interactions is huge, but because the probability that two polar molecules hop onto each other's site is strongly suppressed due to this correlated hopping term.
Does it mean that U should be infinity, not zero?
Yes, U is, I mean, yes, hardcore infinity, yes. So U, so that what I meant is, I don't like this term, I mean hardcore bosons, that U is infinite. But it's not necessarily infinite because the energy for two polar molecules is infinite, but because the hopping for two polar molecules on the same site is strongly suppressed. So that's just a warning. And there are certainly microscopic models where we can circumvent this problem. I can imagine if we make the lattice larger and make very special lattice shapes, we can somehow shield the two polar molecules on each lattice site. But it requires a lot of fine-tuning. So, and for me, therefore, the natural Hamiltonian is hardcore bosons without on-site interaction.
So sorry, you're suggesting to get rid of that term.
But this term is U going to infinite. So we have hardcore bosons.
But it isn't a Hamiltonian.
Okay, I make the hardcore boson constraint.
So that's just a boundary condition.
And then it's a boundary, like here, it's a constraint on my operators. And it's then no longer a Hamiltonian.
Because alternatively, you could have written a Hamiltonian that would have the lattice potential explicitly in it, right?
Oh, I mean, I could also add a correlated hopping term. A term which is, what is the hopping if there is already a particle on the lattice site? And this term is very small. Right. Then I can add here whatever I want. It should give the same physics. But the simplest way is just say, let's make this infinite and get rid of it. And then the question is, do we have an interesting phase here? And the most important question, in my opinion, is the question, is there a supersolid phase? And the answer is yes. If you have dipolar interactions for hardcore bosons, there are supersolid phases. And there are actually two supersolid phases. So supersolid. Phase. Now, there's one in a square lattice.
But by supersolid, you just mean condensation of interstitials or vacancies? Or do you mean something more exotic than that?
No.
So here it's,
yes. I will tell you exactly what I meant. Yeah, in the picture. So there are supersolid phases in a square lattice. That's done by Guido Popilio. That's rather surprising, because if you just take nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor, there is no supersolid. So the supersolid is really only stabilized by the slow decay of the dipolar interaction. So that's very surprising. But as a result, the supersolid phase is very weak. So it's a very small area in a phase diagram. Then there is a supersolid in a triangular lattice. That's not surprising at all, because if you have nearest neighbor interaction, there was already, so ignoring the dipolar part, we knew that there is already supersolid phase in a triangular lattice. And the question was only, does the dipolar interaction destroy it? So let me plot the phase diagram for this triangular lattice. So we have U over J. Then we have two solid phases. One at filling 1 over 3, and one at filling 2 over 3. That means that every third lattice site is occupied, and we think of that. So one is the solid forming with such an occupation. And the second one is the particle hole symmetric. That means this occupation of the particles. And indeed, there's a supersolid phase appearing in between. And we have the superfluid outside. And the advantage here is that the supersolid extends over a large area of chemical potential, because it's the full area between the two insulators where the supersolid can appear. And in addition, if we go with very large U, what we find here is, let's call it devil staircase physics in 2D. So we know that if you have lower filling, there will be some large scale clustering of my atoms, but I don't know how a devil staircase looks like in two dimensions with dipolar interactions. So, and I don't know whether anybody has ever calculated it. So let's call this that down here we have Devil's staircase in 2D and using question marks, because I don't know how it actually looks like. But also in this area we'll get some, at very strong interactions, some superstructures forming and some insulating phases. But I don't think these are very so interesting, because they require very, very strong dipole interaction. Good, so supersolid phases are stabilized by dipole interactions. And that leads me to my last part of my talk that we heard already yesterday by Anna Maria Rey about spin physics with dipolar interactions. So now let's completely quench the motion of the atoms and just look atoms confined in an optical lattice, and can we do spin physics via internal degrees of freedom? So that's spin Hamiltonian. So the idea is deep optical lattice. I still want the polar molecules in 2D, so that we have no tunneling of the particles. And then use some internal states which give rise to an effective spin degree of freedom. Now, there are two comments. So I think everybody here knows it, but maybe there are non-experts here, so let me stress it again. One can ask the questions, a polar molecule is, a perfect polar molecule, is something rotating in all directions. Now, if you have several polar molecules on the line and they interact, then there is a Facebook phase transition appearing. If the interaction is very strong, the polar molecules polarize, and we get a ferroliquid, a ferroelectric. So then the question is, can this happen for polar molecules? So if you look at such spin Hamiltonians, is there a ferroelectric? And what we have to achieve is, if you look at just the lowest four states, these have to spontaneously form at mix the p-valent state to form a dipole moment such that each polar molecule spontaneously form a dipole moment and they arrange in some way, either up-down or up-up in some direction. So that is, I would say, the natural phase transition as a condensed matter physicist, which one would look for. What is required is that the rotation splitting has to be comparable to the dipole interaction. So that has to be to the dipole moment squared divided by this distance between the particles cubed. So if this condition is satisfied, we get this phase transition. Now, unfortunately, the interparticle distance required is 5 nanometers, of the order of 5 nanometers. So that means it will never happen for polar molecules. So there is no ferroelectricity with polar molecules because they are always far apart, and the dipole-dipole interactions is a weak perturbation on the rotational structure. So that's the first point, which is, I think, important if we speak about spin Hamiltonians here. The natural Hamiltonian, natural physics, will never happen.
Is that assuming you're dealing with diatomic molecules?
Yes, yes.
As you could imagine making them heavier and heavier. I agree with the 5 nanometers.
Yes.
Maybe. What value of B are you assuming?
Order of 10 gigahertz.
Yeah, so you could have...
Actually, if you look at the number for all of the mixed alkali, all 10 of them, that number turns out to be roughly half of the Van der Waals radius, which puts it on the order of a few nanometers for any of them.
Yeah.
So I agree.
But maybe if we have your molecules, if you have a huge molecule, that's maybe possible. But on the other hand, yes, we know we have ferroelectric crystals, like piezo crystal. So nature has achieved this, but exactly on a nanometer scale. So nature achieves ferroelectrics, but then it is actually on nanometer scale where the dipole-dipole interactions takes place.
And this is for Hund's case B molecules? This is for Hund's case B molecules?
Now you lost me completely.
Oh, this is like for alkali polar molecules?
Yes.
So, like, what about for OH molecules? Or like Hund's case A?
But Gilvan is saying that there are two states of very.
Yeah, I mean, or let's just like say if these two scales become comparable, then it's also the scale where the molecules start to form crystalline structures. It's where the chemistry happens. So if these two scales are comparable, then typically we expect chemistry effects.
But in OH, what Gunther is saying, OH will not be B any longer.
So this is like a Hund's case B. So n equal 0 and n equal 1 is a nice rotational structure.
Let's discuss this.
Just one comment on the OH. The lambda-Douglas splitting is 2 gigahertz, which is roughly comparable to the B for the mixed alkali. So I don't think you're going to find a different number.
No, but I think even in the case of OH, it's still the rotational constant that matters, because what matters here is that
they can spontaneously change.
Yeah, but they
happen there.
What?
They will couple and just stay like...
They will couple, I mean, the Stark shift is going to be significant, but it's still the rotational motion that you want to kind of freeze, right?
Yeah.
Which is set, I mean, by the rotational constant.
But as a final comment, as we have called it on the gases, we can play tricks. So let's just shine in a microwave field, which takes out this energy. And then, yes, we can make ferroelectrics. So then we don't have static dipole moments, so then we have dipole moments rotating all in phase with each other, but then we can get ferroelectric crystals, and we can ask, can we make ferroelectric liquids? I think something nature doesn't have so far. There are no ferroelectric liquids, but in principle, with this trick, we can ask, are there ferroelectric liquids? So that's, yeah.
And if you had NH3, the frequency is lower then.
What's benzene?
No, well, just because it's going to, because of the conversion, then you're going to dipole make it a lower frequency.
Let's postpone this to afterwards. Yeah. So that's how we make, in that case, spin systems. We select, for example, two rotation states and call them spin up, spin down. And the first work which did this, I want always to stress this, that Andrea Micheli, and they demonstrated that they can realize kit dives on the complex this. So, dive on the comp. Like this model, and that was in 2006 or 5, 6, I think. So, but unfortunately, it's a little bit of complex polymolecules they used, so they preferred strontium fluoride. So, polymolecules which has an electron spin and nuclear spin, no nuclear spin, electron spin, and a rotational coupling between electron spin and rotation. So that is a little bit an exotic molecule, but in principle the idea to create spin systems was pioneered in this work. But there are much simpler ways to make spin systems, as we heard by Anna Maria Rey yesterday. So let's apply an electric field. Then we call this state spin up, the upper state spin down, and we write down our Hamiltonian. So typically we then have Hamiltonians of the form some over I not equal to J S I set S J set with a prefactor J perpendicular plus the J parallel S I X S J X plus S I Y S J Y and everything divided by Ri minus Rj in power of cubed. And you understand where the two terms come from. So this term is a static dipole-dipole interactions. So this one is with a one polar molecules in the lower state, and the other one is also in the lower state. They feel a dipole-dipole interaction. And if they are in a higher state, they feel a different dipole-dipole interaction. That gives to us S set. This term here is the resonance exchange interaction. That if one polar molecule is in a ground state, the other one is in an excited, we can make the flip-flop transition. That this one gets excited, and this one de-excited. And so that's an S plus S minus term, and this gives rise to XY, XX, SY interactions.
That's good. A small correction. It's not the difference in the left. It's not the difference between two downs and two ups. It's the difference between down, down, and down.
The ZC,
of course, it's the same. Right? Sort of up, up, and down, down.
The same yeah. Between this. Right. Yeah, all four terms. Yes. Thanks. Yes. Good. But the question is, what does actually our dipole character do? So that means these Hamiltonians are very nice. Now we can start to study frustrated antiferromagnetism with polar molecules. We can study dynamics of spin systems. The nice thing is, as was pointed out yesterday, the spin temperature is decoupled from the motion degree of freedoms. So we naturally are nearly at zero temperature because we prepare everything in a ground state. But the question is, how can we adiabatically ramp the system into the interesting quantum phases? And the second point is we don't need so strong dipole moments as for all the rest of my talk. So this can already be done with cadmium rubidium. But the question is, what does actually this term here do? And this is my last part of my talk.
They approach, but they sit in a regular pattern of what the atoms. If you want to make nice spin models, they have to sit in some honeycomb.
At the moment, yes, in principle, if you want to have frustrations, put them in a triangular lattice, each atom on one side. You can ask what are defects due to, if some polar molecules are missing, you have disorder added to the system. You have frustrations typically. Or
but we have to come up with a method to, so they sit in that hexagonal or triangular lattice first, and then you freeze them, and then you, or what?
Yeah, so like Chun, look, at the moment, think of what Chun is doing. He ramps up optical lattices, so as some filling factor. Now let's dilute a single plane, and you have a 2D system. You have some atoms filled. Not every site is perfectly filled. But if you make it anti-ferromagnetic coupling, and you don't have every site filled, you automatically add frustration. So you get an automatically disordered, frustrated system for anti-ferromagnetic interaction.
But it's a random lattice in this case?
In that sense, it would be a random distribution of atoms, yes. If you manage to make a Mott insulator first, that you really have nearly unity filling, and then you change your lattice structure from triangular, honeycomb, square lattice, one can start to study such physics. So, yeah, the goal is to demonstrate that you can reach near unity filling with the polar molecules. I don't know how to achieve that. That's probably the hardest part. But there are a lot of interesting questions also if it's not completely filled. And so let us look at the simplest case, or for me the simplest case. So let's look at XY ferromagnet. That we achieve for K parallel negative and absolute value of K parallel much larger than absolute value of J such that the XY interaction is ferromagnetic and dominates over the CC interaction. Then what we expect at zero temperature, we have perfect order. So all polar molecules, for example, lie along the X direction. So polarization along X directions, but we have a continuously broken symmetry. So the system, all polar molecules can either show in X, Y, or any angle in between. So that means that at T not equal zero, and we describe the physics, we have the well-known Murray-Wagner theorem, which tells us that we have quasi long-range order. We get a constellate Fowler space transition at final temperature. And in all the situations, all this physics is driven by the linear Goldstone mode. So everything of this quasi long range order is given by the linear Goldstone mode. And all this is correct if my interactions will decay with one with an exponent faster than 1 over r to the 4. So this is correct if I have an interaction decay with 1 over r alpha, with alpha larger than 4. Now, Dipler interaction decays with 1 over r cubed, and therefore, everything what we know about Merwin-Wagner or about classical XY models is not valid. So dipolar or 1 over r cubed, which fundamentally changes all the properties of this XY phase. So what do we receive, obtain? Let us look at the Goldstone mode. There is no linear Goldstone mode anymore, but it's actually an anomalous mode with a square root of cube behavior. So mode will be square root of absolute value of Q. That will be the low energy modes in a system. That tells us that if you want to calculate what is the energy between a vortex and the vortex pair, this energy is actually linearly confining. So vortex anti-vortex pair are combining. And that means that we have two long-range order in two dimensions of a broken continuous symmetry. With a conventional phase transition appearing at a finite temperature. And if one looks at the universality class of the phase transition, the thermal phase transition is actually exactly at its upper critical dimension. So it's actually a mean field phase transition. So finite temperature phase transition or phase transition is mean field, which in the end justifies how we derive these properties by using mean field plus spin wave analysis. But if the phase transition is actually mean field, then all these properties are well justified. And so that's another example where dipolar interactions fundamentally change the physics. And it's maybe to point out that it's not a contradiction to Merman-Wagner theorem, but Merman-Wagner theorem stated that your interactions has to decay with an exponent faster than for r to the 4. And therefore, with dipolar interactions, we do not have to satisfy Merman-Wagner theorem. And therefore, it strongly depends on which situations we are. And just to comment finally, if you look at the antiferromagnetic situation, there we have a cancellation of this dipole-dipole interaction, and then we recover all the physics here. So in an antiferromagnetic case, we have a Kosterlitz-Fowlis transition, quasi-two-dimensional, quasi-long-range order. But it's a ferromagnetic situation, which is fundamentally changed. And with that, I'm at my end. I hope I could show you a little bit of strongly correlated physics and some special properties of dipolar interactions. Thank you for your attention.
So I guess we're basically at an hour, or so you want to have any quick questions?
Maybe start a little bit late, so let's have
signal, experimental signatures of these different behaviors is just measuring the vortices of how they could prove that we have a true beam field.
So if you would measure, so let's see, you have to measure the spin of two separated particles. Mm-hmm. So spin-spin correlation. So how you measure spin-spin is not so clear. Probably you have to rotate it by 90 degrees, map spin in x direction. Yeah, somehow you have to bulkily measure it and resolve it spatially. Mm-hmm. And then see that there are actually no fluctuations. So typically, the spin-spin correlation function will decay algebraically, mm-hmm. but here it should be just long range all the time. Mm-hmm. So it's a finite value. But I agree, it's a long range physics phenomena. So you have to go to large distances. On short distances, everything looks the same.
So if you map this spin model into particle bosons on a lattice, and can you apply that argument there for the second order phase transition to those particle bosons, or does this argument hold only without a lattice?
Okay, now, so here we had particle bosons, but short-range hopping. Now the big difference between the two models is that the hopping decays also with our 1 over r cubed. So once Yes, so as soon as you are hopping, decaying 1 over r cubed, you have such properties.
So the argument there for the second order phase transition?
No, that's a different one.
That's the one I was asking about. So can you apply this argument to those particle bosons?
Yes, I think so, yes. So you mean to these particle bosons? We can discuss it, we can think about it. In general, I would say yes. So what you need is an order parameter, the first order phase transition where you get a jump in an observable which has a dipolar interaction. And then it will apply. So yes, I think so, yes.
Just one comment I think worth making is that your fourth case here with all this very interesting new physics looks to me like what they're going to get to experimentally first, because that's what they can do now. They only require the microwaves with molecules isolated in separate cells. So the object is to get the phase space density up in higher occupancy, I guess.
Yeah.
For the experimental.
Yes.
So if there is something very short and very urgent.
Just a very quick question. This melting, this argument that it's a mean field and not causing showers.
Yes.
Does that also apply to this phase transition over there?
No.
It does not?
No. So
that's really.
So all what I said here is really for the XY phase of this model.
Okay.
Not because here you have short range hopping kinetic energy like with a short range. And think of it that here I have a model with long range hopping or longer range hopping, a hopping which decays like 1/r³. While here you have a hopping which is normal short range. And it's this long range hopping which makes this physics. So no, I cannot apply it here. Really.